Nothing to disclose except I'm a government employee, and this work represents me and not the government. So, and we heard about some of the devastating consequences of infertility for mental disorders, but this is to say that infertility is, despite this, it's more than a quality of life issue, and it actually is considered a disease by both the World Health Organization and the American Society of Reproductive Medicine in position statements made in the last 5 years. And that reproduction is a major life activity. So this is from an interesting Supreme Court case of Bragdon versus Abbott in 1998, in which it was concluded again that it was a major life activity under the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990, and that reproduction and the dynamics surrounding it are central to the life process itself. And if you're interested, I encourage you to take a look at this case law. It was it was fascinating. From a public health standpoint, infertility is a big public health concern. As we just heard from the last speaker, there are major disparities in access to care and to treatment, and frankly, in many of the risk factors for infertility itself. As an example, African-American women are more likely to experience tubal factor infertility, but less likely to seek care and treatment. And as use of infertility treatments increases, again, nearly 1.5% of infants are now born in the U.S. from use of assisted reproductive technologies, it's a concern that we don't know the long-term outcomes of these treatments. We have no idea what the safety is for intravenous insemination, ovulation medications, and for in vitro. Also, from a public health standpoint, infertility goes far beyond just having children. It actually is a marker of past, present, and future health, and it's a window to detect unrecognized health conditions. And so this is some recent articles that came out that showed for men, infertility is associated with both prostate and testes cancers and with increased mortality, and those are based on semen analyses. Many of the factors that contribute to infertility can be prevented. Again, this is a public health perspective, and if you can eliminate some of these exposures, you will eliminate some of the infertility. And so if you take a look at sexually transmitted infections, particularly chlamydia and gonorrhea, those can be easily treated and prevented. And even environmental and workplace exposures can affect biologic capacity, and by that, it affects sperm quality and disrupt menstrual function. Again, you eliminate these exposures, you potentially eliminate some of the infertility, although quantity is unknown. Same thing with chronic conditions, medications, behavioral factors. So, for example, chemotherapy can result in infertility, and that you really should take a look at fertility preservation methods for men or women who are experiencing autoimmune disorders or cancer, and do this before treatment starts. Again, a public health issue. And also modifiable life factors that are well-known threats to public health, so whether it's obesity or smoking, also are related to infertility. So where does this take us? So I've told you this has been a multi-year effort. Back in 2010, we published a white paper focusing on stating that infertility prevention, detection, and management in fact was a public health issue. This was published in Fertility and Sterility. I'm very pleased to announce that in 2014, this past summer, we finally released this National Action Plan on Infertility that's really a blueprint of what different partners can do, government, non-government, academia, professional organizations such as the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, the American Urologic Association, the American Andrology Society. There are a lot of folks who are now behind this. I think what angers it is the public health approach that's taking it away from the individual and presenting it as a public health issue. So in the next few minutes, I want to talk about some of the outlines of the strategies, and we have the action plan in the back as well as a recent report that we did on men's reproductive health. So the three main goals of the strategy were to promote healthy behaviors to preserve fertility, to emphasize early detection and prevention of medical conditions that can lead to infertility, and also to reduce exposures to hazardous agents that may affect one's fertility. In addition to having this in the back, this is also available on CESA's website at the link below. So for detection of infertility, there are several public health opportunities. One, we've got to have some standardized case definitions. As Susan said at the beginning, what's defined as infertility is actually different from impaired fecundity. How the studies collect data, is it a success at achieving pregnancy, success at having a birth? You cannot compare across different studies and populations, which undermines our efforts to present infertility as a public health problem. We also need improved surveillance for infertility and related factors. So we have existing surveillance systems, and Tim mentioned the National ART Surveillance System, which we have in our division at CDC, that collects data on ART cycles. But we know nothing, almost nothing about non-ART use and any of the outcomes associated with this. Again, this is a potential public health issue. We need to take a look and improve our understanding of the risk and causes of infertility, many of which I mentioned a few slides back. Okay, good. And we need to increase public awareness of the causes of infertility and how important it is to prevent it. This is particularly for younger people who may do risk behaviors. We're doing some work at looking at young men who are taking exogenous testosterones and not for medical indications, which can lead to infertility, also sexually transmitted infections. So these are areas in which we can certainly make a difference from public health. And then for the management of infertility, we have public health opportunities, certainly in monitoring the safety and effectiveness of infertility treatments as treatment use becomes increased. For ART, we know whether it's associated with low birth weight and prematurity. We know nothing about the long-term outcomes. We have done some work linking to different registries, hospital discharge registries, cancer registries we're starting to do, and also actually to an autism registry, which we've done, which has yielded interesting results. Again, for non-ART, we know very, very little about it, but the use, we believe, is 3 to 4 times as much as that for ART. And we know nothing about the short-term or long-term outcomes on a public health population perspective. We in public health also need to do a better job of promoting evidence-based guidelines and recommendations from entities such as the SRM, AUA, ASA, and then to increase the awareness so we can eliminate disparities in access to affordable infertility services. Again, as we just heard from last speaker, we have use at over 5 to 6% in some states and far lower in others because some states have mandated coverage. So with that, I'm within my 10 minutes. I want to thank you for your attention, again, for sticking it out, and I hope this is giving you a vision of what we're trying to do at CDC to generate more attention to the issue from a public health perspective. Thank you. I did it. 9:35, I had 10 minutes.
That's great. So despite the fact that this is at the end of the conference, we have time for some questions. And yes.
Sure. ART is mostly in vitro fertilization, and non-ART can refer to not as much intrauterine insemination, but more use of Clomid and other medications that are given, that they're less expensive to give than an ART cycle, which can cost $12,000 to $15,000. And as we heard in the first presentation, it makes it cost prohibitive.
It's
mostly right. IVF is 99% of it. There's some other, it's called GIFT and ZIFT. Those aren't really a major factor. We are under congressional mandate since 1992 to collect data on every cycle of ART conducted in the United States. And so that originated, just to give you a little history, because there were concerns that fertility service providers were overstating their effect
or at birth. So Congress started regulating that. And so now we have data for up to, back to 1995.
Would you all come up here?
We'll take our questions.
Well, with the new APCD data that's coming out, do you think that's going to affect how we're the all payers claim database?
Okay.
Is that going to affect the surveillance of non-ART, like fertility enhancing drug use? Are we going to have more data on that?
We should have more data, but it's not going to. No one's going to regulate the quality as much as we have in HAPS. So we give a report out every year, annually, of ART success, treatment, use of procedures, and we do validation sites visits to look at the quality of the data that's coming in. So I think it'll help complete the picture, but it would be nice if we had a similar system that was mandated.
Yeah. I have a question for the last presenter. There's a list of risk factors for related to infertility, and I didn't notice age listed in there, specifically advanced maternal age. I'm wondering if that's just not as big of an issue as I perceive it to be or heard it to be in the past, and also if there's a reason why, you know, perhaps younger maternal age is included in recommendations because of social factors, or why I didn't see that in there.
That's a good question, and I chose the risk factors that were clear public health issues. You have a balance when you're talking about when women or couples should conceive. I actually have a great slide that was similar to who presented the one on NSFG on the age groups. There's a huge increase by age for women, less so for men, patrolling for age of women. But you have many women who are delaying childbirth until later in life or getting married later. So it's more of a demographic difference, but it is a major, I would say risk factor, but it's a major factor associated with infertility. But it's a very good point.
Other questions?
I guess it's not necessarily a question, but it's kind of related to your last slide mentioning raising awareness and the affordability of IVF. And I don't know if any of you have all looked at some of the websites that the IVF clinic have, but it's not, I mean, it's a medical thing, but it seems to be a very sales-oriented environment. And my colleague and I were randomly chatting the other day, and we were talking about, you know, it's a medical thing, but it's a profit-oriented environment, and kind of similar to maybe some substance abuse facilities too. We're just, you know, thinking about this and how could there be information available to the public, consumers, patients that can make sense of this and not have it be coming from the people who are selling it. I guess
this is a growing issue. And actually, Deborah Spahr, who is now the president of Barnard, has a book called The Baby Business. Where she talks about these issues and the history of IVF is very, and policies and oversight is very much linked to sensitivities actually around abortion and reproduction. And so you have the fertility industry growing up outside of most insurance regulation, outside, even though, yes, they are regulated as clinics and the doctors are regulated as physicians, there's a whole industry of egg brokers, all of which are not regulated. And so it's interesting if we think about, however we feel about health insurance, the private health insurance market, which I'm sure we all have mixed feelings about it, but there is also a certain amount of oversight and accountability that comes from insurance coverage, and so the idea of how do we create a system that doesn't restrict people's reproductive decisions, but also creates a lot more accountability. Mm-hmm. I think is something that many of us are looking at, because that's right, they advertise, they often very much minimize the health risks, and then, you know, they may have more about the health risks in the informed consent documents, but we all know what informed consent documents look like, and people are already well into the process before they see those documents, but there's really very little accountability for making sure that, that people have much better information than they have. And the CDC is really on top of this.
We're trying. Now, I want to point out, even though we're the nation's public health agency, we are not a regulatory body. Now, we are mandated to collect surveillance data and look at the quality, and so there is some teeth to that. But I think framing it as what are the health concerns and elevating that discussion to more of a public health, so women who are egg donors, women who are receiving donations of 6 to 7 embryos, that should not happen. And if we can draw attention to this from a public health perspective, I think that makes a stronger case.
In our qualitative data, this is something that patients have talked about, too, their concerns about, we've had people say both that, you know, so they've gone to a clinic and they've been turned away because of the age or something, yeah. And some people have the perception that, well, they just don't want to treat me because they want to keep their numbers up on the SARD website, so they don't want to take a risk that we won't get pregnant. You know, and I'm thinking, like, well, or maybe, you know, they don't want to take your money if they know that they can't help you, you know. And then on the flip side, we've also had people who will talk about they just want to take our money even though our chances aren't good. So they're on both sides of that issue. Patients, and we also have patients who say, well, I trust the doctor, they're going to tell me what's done.
I would encourage you to grab one of those action plans. We discussed some of the risks, and I think your point, Elizabeth, is great. These are one of the, it's a conflict. So people look at the CC website or the SART website, depending on where they're looking, and they're looking at what's my success rate. And but if there's patient selection in there issues, then again, it's a conflict of interest. A clinic only wants to take the best patients who can they work with. And so we are trying to work with our website to make it clear and transparent and to offset some of the patient selectivity factors that a clinic may use. So one thing that one of my colleagues, Dimitri Kissin, who's in charge of our ART surveillance system, does, they put a new indicator in the report, and that's the birth of a healthy singleton infant. And that helps level the playing field. Their advantage. We have been working with interactively, who helped us with this action plan, is Aetna, who are really starting to look at the cost of these health outcomes. And then to your other question about the long-term outcomes, we don't have the data on this. We don't have it.
And stress on the mother's body.
Yes.
Or carrying multiple births.
It's not just the infant, it's the mother as well.
And when you talk about the egg provider, there's absolutely no data. And in fact, I don't know if, I'm sorry, you were over there, Lindsay. I don't know if the group We Are Egg Donors are the folks that you're working with. But so there is this group called We Are Egg Donors who have a blog and are collecting information from women who have provided eggs to create a policy movement, because all this clinic data is only about, even the health effects that you're starting to want to get to are only about the intended parent, and they're not at all about the women who are providing the eggs.
And we also do some work in India, so we've done surrogacy work there, and there's no regulation around the number of times that women can donate their eggs, which increases their health risk, for sure.
I just wanted to So beyond working with some insurers and looking at that information, is there any kind of surveillance or monitoring of the companies that financing companies Attain is the group that the clinic program recruiting works with, where there's information about Attain on the clinic website for people, so it's ways of financing. People can purchase packages for IVF where you get three fresh or three frozen cycles for as much money. If you meet these medical qualifications, you can get partial or even full reimbursement if you don't have success, which they can just bring home a live baby. Is there any kind of oversight?
Not from us.
Okay.
So it could be from some other body. I mean, do you know anything about any of the regulations with egg donors?
Sure.
Oh, sorry.
Are you familiar with any of the regulations? So
I think
egg donors. I think it's something that's getting increased attention as the use of procedures is increasing. There's a lot more attention to egg donors. And we actually have enough now where we're starting to look at this out of the ART surveillance system. Again, as was noted earlier, there were 60,000 cycles a year. And over a number of years, we are having a large database where we can start looking at this. Now, we can't go into the level of detail that we'd like to, because we can only collect so much data, but we can start taking a look at this. And I think it's a huge issue.
The AFRM has guidelines, but there was a report out of the Hastings Institute that they are pretty much routinely not followed, and there's no enforcement mechanism. The Nadja Solomon's doctor, she was called Optimum. It was one of the first doctors that they ASRM disciplined in, apparently, in many, many years. So that, it's good to have guidelines, but it's insufficient in terms of any kind of monitoring enforcement.
We did actually a public health grand rounds. That's what some of these slides were from back in August at CDC. And if you haven't seen it, I encourage you to take a look at the whole session. Now, my session was on the public health aspects of infertility, but there were some subsequent ones that were on what you're talking about it's not just guidelines, it's guidelines plus having the insurers and the reimbursement tied to it. And when you start doing that, you start seeing some adherence. And so what we have seen over the past few years are a decrease in the number of embryos transferred, whereas it used to be, I don't know the exact proportions, maybe 15% more than three embryos. That's severely been reduced, but the number of twins, two embryos that yielded twins, is increased. So you're doing better, but you're still not getting to the end. So the percent of cycles with single embryo transfer, I think, is around 8 to 10%, which is about a tenfold increase from 5 to 6 years ago. So it's progress, and we're making progress, but it is incremental. And if you look at some of the other countries that have made a policy for a single embryo transfer, and not just a recommendation, the increase is dramatic. It takes effect immediately.
Right. So like you look in the UK and the regulation under the HFEA, you have single embryo transfer, you have insurance coverage. There was a problem there because they weren't covering same-sex families, and now they're changing that. So there is something to be said for a comprehensive system that allows people to make decisions, but also really has a lot of enforcement. Do we have time for maybe one more question or comment? All right, it's lunchtime. I want to thank our speakers. You guys were wonderful.